If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Basically. I'm your host, Stephanie Preisner, and with me in studio today is consultant spine surgeon and director of spine and orthopedics for the Mater Private Network, Ashley Poynton. Are you Dr. Ashley Poynton or Professor Ashley, Mr.? I never really know. It's like the more qualified you get, the less title you get.
Yeah, Mr. is what I'm supposed to be, but so most of my patients call me by my first name.
Okay.
I'm pretty informal.
That's good. Is that a different style for every doctor? Or
yeah, some people like the title. I think you got to try and connect with people and be normal.
Okay, so talk to me about your training. You are a spinal surgeon. So at what point in your medical career or training were you like, spines, that's what I want to do, and surgery, that's what I want to do?
Yeah, surgery happened pretty early. I went to Trinity for medicine. Didn't like it.
Okay.
The first 3 years.
That's a long time to stick with
something. Yeah, it is. Then it was 6 year course.
Okay.
And
what is it now?
It's five. I understand it's five. It might be still six, but I think it's six now or five now for most colleges. But I didn't want to do it. Didn't sort of got there by default and wanted to be a vet.
Okay.
And
just don't like humans.
Well, I wasn't sure. I mean, you know, when you're 17, making the choice, it's pretty difficult. So got into medicine, didn't like the first 3 years. Then I found anatomy. I thought that was pretty good. That was in the first few years, but really didn't know.
And are the first 3 years a lot of book learning?
Yeah,
or when do you start to get into it?
Yeah, you don't see a patient in certainly the system I was in, didn't see a patient for the first 3 years.
Okay.
So you really...
It's a lot of books.
Querying yourself, is this the right choice? And then I got into clinical practice in hospitals and found surgery. I thought that was pretty cool. I understood it. It was what I liked. Mm-hmm. And then one day I went into an orthopedic theater. I saw somebody doing a knee replacement. And I said, I like that. I like the tools. I like the
It's like Lego Meccano.
Like Meccano.
Yeah.
And so I was really keen on orthopedics. And that's kind of when I decided I wanted to do orthopedics. So I did that. And then early on in my training, I knew I wanted to be a spine surgeon. And the reason, I think it's a difficult specialty. It always struck me that people were nervous doing it. It was risky. There was sort of an edge in theater. I thought it was exciting. The stakes were pretty high. And that really attracted me. So that's the journey I went on, and then went to the New York for 2 years to finish my training in spine, then came back 20 years ago to the Mater. And
been there since.
That's it. So to become a spine surgeon, you either start off in orthopedics or you start off in neurosurgery.
Okay.
And modern spine surgery, doesn't really matter whether you're a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic surgeon, you just need to subspecialize in spine and get specific training in spine.
And we'll come to what that involves and how sort of technology has the evolution of technology and its impact on the surgery. But going back to the orthopedic element, which we'll touch on briefly, is that like hip replacements, knee replacements, soccer injuries?
Yeah, so orthopedics would be joint replacement, sports injuries. There's a lot of trauma in orthopedics, so it's really orthopedics and trauma would be the specialist. So broken bones, that's a big part of what you do as an orthopedic surgeon. And then there's the subspecialties within that, which is joint replacement, foot and ankle, hand and shoulder, and then spine.
So there's probably a lot more people who will interact with an orthopedic surgeon than a spinal surgeon.
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then talk to us about spinal surgery. is it, we had a cardiologist on and he was explaining to us, that we had Professor Byrne on, he was talking about the difference between, you know, being a cardiologist doctor and also the fact that he has to kind of pivot into surgery sometimes, but you can also have a heart surgeon. Is that tension of like the stakes are really high here, is it greater in a theatre that is operating on a spine than it would be on a heart? Because, you know, you'd imagine a heart is a vital organ.
It is, yeah. So I've never sort of felt that tense in theatre. Some people are. It can be quite difficult, particularly when you're training and early on. Mm-hmm. But I think the more you do, the more you train and the more experience you have, even at an early stage in your career, the more comfortable you get with operating and the less nervous you get. And I think you don't, the last thing you need is a nervous surgeon.
Yes, and yeah.
You do see them.
Really?
But yes, there is that element that, yeah, you know, I describe it as skating on thin ice all the time. That,
do you have like music playing? Do you have,
sometimes,
do you keep,
yeah,
your surgery,
yeah,
a certain way?
Yeah, yeah. I tend to do the same thing all the time. Okay. Certainly in certain procedures, you have a routine that you do.
What's the longest procedure that you've done?
Probably about 12 hours.
Straight through?
Yeah, yeah. Now, you might take a break in between. Now, that's not common. That would be very difficult, either a major spinal deformity correction or a really difficult resection of a tumor.
Okay.
But most of them are under 2 hours.
What do you see the most? So when we spoke to the cardiologist, it was, you know, heart attack, how we can keep our hearts healthy or whatever. What do you see the most? And also, what, as a spinal surgeon, would you never do that the population do because of what you see?
The most common things would be degenerative conditions of the spine. So wear and tear, neck pain, bone overgrowth causing pinched nerves, pinched spinal cord. Same in the low back. Low back would be even more frequent. Mm-hmm. Back pain, wear and tear, disc protrusions, bone spurs growing into the spinal canal. So that's very, very common.
Yeah, a physiotherapist once told me that if you did an MRI of like the whole population, about 80% of people would have discs in the wrong place, or just because of our lifestyle.
Yeah, and there is an aging process to the spine. Okay. So the studies, there's good studies to show the percentage of the population that have degenerative change and bulging discs or whatever there is there as one ages. So if you take, say, over 65, over 70, everyone has fairly significant issues that you'd see on an MRI, but they may not have any symptoms at all. So it's really important to understand that. And when you go to treat someone, you have to put what is expected on the MRI into context. So not everything needs to be treated, not everything you need to worry about.
Yeah.
Everyone gets fixated on bulging discs and torn discs and bone spurs, but it's often very normal and doesn't cause any problems. So
spinal surgery, I know from a friend of mine who's having one, is like, it's no joke, and the recovery is, you know, kind of intense because you're having, well, on some of them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not something to just like jump into.
No, and I think you have to, again, sometimes you have to, there's no alternative. Mm-hmm. So if you're a spinal cord compression and somebody's losing power in their arm or their legs or whatever,
there's no choice
and you just take it as it comes. But if you're suffering, say, with back pain or sciatica, which is pain down your leg, you've had it for a while, you'd look at all the different options. You don't necessarily need surgery, and often a completely conservative approach will work quite well. A lot of disc protrusions, for example, will get better on their own. So it's all about case selection. It's about timing. It's about talking to people what they want, because not everyone wants to be managed. Oh, well, will you take 3 months off work and do rehab, or will you have a surgery and get quick fix and go back to work? But most times we're fairly conservative with surgery because often it's not necessary, which is obviously you don't do it. But in many cases, these things get better, particularly back pain, leg pain.
Can be conservatively managed.
Just goes away.
And
but the more serious things don't, and you have to treat them surgically.
What are things that you don't do? Like, how has your lifestyle changed based on the things that you see coming through your door? I'm wondering about things like motorcycles, trampolines? Like, are there anything that you're like, that's actually really dodgy, but people don't know it and they don't know the injuries that it can cause?
I try to not think about these things. So okay. I try to build that wall around myself and not do it. But there are a few things that I wouldn't do. Yeah. I would love to have a motorbike, I really would, but I think I'd be divorced straight away if I got one.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, yes, lots of people use them, but they are dangerous. And it's often not the motorcyclists, it's people around them, the motorists around them that create the danger.
Danger, yes, yeah.
So instead of a motorbike, I got a jet ski, which is almost as good.
Except there's more less
chance of being killed, but yeah. Maybe you'd be seriously injured. The other thing, which is really dangerous, which is a big issue, are quad bikes, and they are seriously dangerous pieces of machinery. And
a lot of people really think young kids have those.
That's the problem.
Okay.
So we see major injuries off quad bikes, particularly kids and teenagers who just don't know how to use them and do too much and flip over and they break their spines, get paralyzed or get killed. And so I think you have to stay away from things like that. Now, you can still use them safely. Everything mm-hmm. can be used safely. A lot of farms will have a quad bike on them and they're perfectly safe if they're used correctly. But if you're a little bit wild on one, you put yourself at serious risk. Beyond that, I ski, I water ski. I got into a thing called heli skiing at one stage, which was getting out of helicopters in the middle of nowhere on top of the mountains.
Joking.
So you don't think about it. And one thing that does is you forget about work. You don't think about anything else apart from what's in front of you.
And is that a tough thing to do? Like, is it hard as a surgeon, as any kind of medical professional to leave the job behind?
It is, yeah. And some of it is that have to be available all the time, particularly in, say, in private practice. Most private surgeons, or whether you have a mixed public-private practice, you're on call all the time. Mm-hmm. You have to have your phone on. If you've operated on someone, even the previous week, you need to be either have some cover for you or you need to be available. So it's not uncommon to get a call on a Saturday night saying that the surgery you did on previous, say, Wednesday or Thursday is a problem. So
would they still be in hospital now? Or maybe?
Sometimes they will. The bigger ones, yes. So you need to be aware of what's still in the hospital. Okay. But sometimes they won't. You'll get a call on a Sunday afternoon saying somebody has gone home and they have a problem. So that's pretty intrusive. It's also with modern technology, people can get you anywhere unless you turn your phone off, which you can't unless you have somebody
covering for you.
But in terms of your mind, it's hard enough to switch off. And that, I think some of the more physically onerous and maybe high adrenaline stuff, you can't think of anything else. So
you have to be right in the moment.
Yeah.
And then in terms of the actual surgery, I know there are various types, but talk us through like a general spinal procedure, like how many people are in the room, who's doing what, when you put knife to skin, like, do you do all that? Or now that you're at a certain level, are there sort of regs, people training underneath you that might start a surgery and then you'll finish it off? Or
yeah, at the moment I do all my own surgery, start to finish. I don't have anyone do any part of them. A very easy, simple operation is what we call a microdiscectomy, which is just taking a piece of disc out of the spinal canal underneath the nerve. So that would be me and the nurse, the scrub nurse, and an anaesthetist. And then there's usually one or two nurses circulating in the operating theatre. Mm-hmm. And that's very easy operation. Takes anywhere from 20 minutes to 40 minutes or a little bit longer.
Oh, wow.
So it's pretty easy. Another common operation would be doing a disc removal in the neck, for example. And most neck surgery is done through the front of the neck. So we go through the throat. There's a few bits and pieces in there. But you'd be surprised. We'd sort of get those out of the way pretty fast, quickly. Get down. The spine is actually quite close to the surface. And take the disc out, free up the spinal cord or the nerves, whatever is compressed, and then replace the disc either with an artificial disc or a what's called a fusion, which is a little block, and then a plate and screws. And that surgery, it sounds really complex. And when you say it to somebody initially, they say, whoa, I don't think I want that. But it's actually pretty simple. And you, now, there are risks with all of these things, but I think for people listening, it's important to understand that if you need this type of surgery, it's not that risky. In fact, it's pretty low risk. And most times you'd go home a day or two later.
Like you'd be doing these frequently, like all the
time. Yeah. The group I'm in, we did 1,100 surgeries last year.
Oh, wow.
Between three of us.
Okay.
So, yeah, we do a lot of surgery, maybe 20 a week.
Has technology or, I guess, scientific advancement changed the outcome for people? So, like, when I was growing up, you know, on the sports field, like you'd hear about, oh, someone was in a rugby scrum and they broke their back and now they're paralyzed, or they broke their neck and now they're paralyzed. Are those outcomes changing in the same way that we see sort of like disease, like where you may have died of one disease, now we have treatments for it? Or is the outcome kind of the same when it comes to spines? Like they're very delicate.
Well, I think spinal cord injuries, unfortunately, the outcome hasn't changed very much.
Okay.
The care has changed a lot, and supporting people, and particularly in the early stages, and also longer term care, reducing complications and the secondary effects of a spinal cord injury, and managing those correctly.
And is a spinal cord injury, like, I know that the cord runs up the center of the spine. Is it just like the spine has been damaged so much that it's damaged kind of like its internal core?
Yeah, so if the cord, which is like a big fiber optic cable, if that is severely damaged or severed, it's not going to get better in many cases. Sometimes it does, but in what we call complete injuries, where there's no function below the level of injury, they tend not to get better. The prognosis is not good. And unfortunately, despite science and everything, there's no cure yet. There's lots of research going on, but it's slow.
It's slow.
Yeah.
But in terms of the like not spinal cord, then spinal injuries, has technology advanced though?
Yeah. So the management of spinal trauma, management of spinal conditions is much different now. I think surgery is much more frequent. So the experience with surgery and doing it quickly in a lot of injuries, doing it efficiently, often less invasive surgery, but it's also that philosophy of getting people out of bed very quickly, mobilizing them. So in many cases, after spine surgery, you get up the same day, you walk, you may go home the day after. Some is now done as day case surgery. So that's a lot different than, say, when I started training after a disc surgery, you might spend a week in bed after it. Now, two, three, 4 hours after surgery, you're up on the corridor and go home the next day. So that has made a big difference.
And is that, this is kind of a crass question, but is that like where capitalism meets medicine and it's like, we need the bed, we're going to like get more, or is it actually science shows us that if you mobilize and you get this joint lubricated, you're going to...
Yeah, early mobilization is really important. And that's not only in spine, it's the same with hips and knees, but it's the same with any surgery and any injury. The quicker
science
you get moving...
We've learned more, so
yeah, we're not worried about, oh, you have to be quiet for... Now, there are limits to what you do. You can't sort of go to the gym day after surgery, but you can get up, you can walk, you can move. And it's really important to get people to know that before the surgery, not after it, so that they know, okay, I'm going to be getting out of bed 4 hours after surgery. I'm going to be walking. The physio might be with me. And then within 12 hours, I can get out and go to the bathroom on my own. And that's really important that people realize that.
Before we move on to some listener questions that came in, when you have a spinal surgery, do you lie on your back after, like, can you lie on your back in the bed then?
Yeah. So most people will, if it's on your back, most people will lie right on the wound.
Oh, wow.
And you can lie on your side, but it's, yeah, a lot of people think you can't, but yeah.
I had surgery on my stomach once and I had to lie in my, like, I wasn't allowed to lie in my stomach.
Yeah, no, we'd let people.
That's cool. I'm going to take a quick break to tell you about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Rockwell Financial, and they have a special offer for Basically listeners. Rockwell Financial protect, but also enhance the wealth of SME owners. If you own a small or medium enterprise, or you are a sole trader in Ireland, Rockwell Wealth Management will protect and enhance your wealth. And they have a free consultation for Basically listeners. So call them up, tell them you're a Basically listener, and they will give you a one-to-one consultation for free. We all know neck and back pain can be so debilitating. The good news is the vast majority of spinal problems can be treated successfully by regaining movement, flexibility and strength. Whether you have an existing condition or a recent injury, Mater Private has centres of excellence for spinal care in Dublin, Cork and Limerick to provide you with comprehensive diagnosis, treatment, surgery and rehabilitation. With daily clinics in five locations, it means you can access the expert spine care that you need without having far to travel, no matter where you live. Making the right move is important, and when you have neck or back pain, you want to be treated by Ireland's leading spine experts. You want a team who can look after everything spinal, from the straightforward to the most complex conditions. For everything spinal, visit matterprivate.ie to find out more.
Here at the podcast studios, we're opening our doors to everyone this Culture Night. Come see the place where your favourite Headstuff shows are made. Get behind-the-scenes access, learn about production, and record your very own five-minute podcast. This is an opportunity not to be missed. Join us on Friday, 22nd of September. Register on eventbrite.ie or see the Culture Night website for details. We look forward to seeing you there.
Okay, so I have some questions from listeners, and if you don't want to answer them, then that's fair enough, because sometimes you need a lot of more information than someone can put in like 30 words. Okay, so returning to high impact exercises like CrossFit after a herniated disc, what are the chances of herniating again if I manage to heal from a herniated cervical disc?
Yeah, that's a question I get asked a lot. So I think CrossFit is pretty aggressive, but so is rugby and other contact sports and all high impact sports. So I think the best answer to that is you gradually increase the intensity of your exercise. You make sure that you're strong, your core is strong, the muscles around that area are strong and fully rehabilitated. And then it's okay. It doesn't completely protect you. So if you take, say, a disc herniation.
What is that?
That's where it pops and it goes backwards into the spinal canal and either hits a nerve or hits
And does
the
it come back
board.
Itself through physio?
A lot of them will shrink down on their own or with rehab, but sometimes after surgery as well. And quite often after surgery, I'll get asked, well, can I go back and run or can I do a sport? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. But it's always a balance. So if you're, say, a professional athlete, you're going to go back. That's your job. That's your career. Mm-hmm. If you're a recreational athlete, you might modify what you do. But often it depends on symptoms. It depends on what the pathology is. But in the short answer is you don't always have to give things up.
Just go back slowly. Why is the condition on adhesive arachnoiditis?
Arachnoiditis, yeah.
Not acknowledged by clinicians. Well, you knew what it was.
Yeah, no, it is acknowledged. It is acknowledged by some. So what that is after spine surgery, and some people, and it can be even small surgery, the nerves, particularly in the low back area. So just a quick anatomy lesson. You've got the spinal cord sort of runs down to the bottom of the chest area.
Yeah.
And then it turns into nerves. All the nerves come off it. So they're like cables coming down through the lumbar spine, which is your low back. And after certain types of surgery, they can get stuck to the in. So they're all covered by a sleeve, which we call the dura, which keeps all the fluid in. And they all swim around, just float around in space. And they're all loose and free. And they don't. And so, because they need to move when you're walking and you're stretching, the nerves actually move a bit. Now, adhesive arachnoiditis is when all of those get stuck to the inside of the dura, they get clumped and they go into the periphery and they can't move. They're all stuck down, and that can cause pain. It can cause what we call neuropathic pain. So people get burning in their legs or their feet. It can cause back pain as well. And it definitely does exist, and we do see it. And you see it after surgery, and you can pick it up on an MRI. You can see there's a characteristic appearance. It's really hard to treat. That's the problem. Okay. So, and a lot of people will say, well, I can't help you. There's nothing I can do. And it's not that it doesn't exist. It's just very difficult to treat.
If something goes wrong with your spine, are you better off being under public or private care?
It depends what's wrong.
Okay.
So most of the spinal trauma and spinal cord injuries are done in the public system, and they would be looked after, and the skill set and teams to look after that, whether it's acute surgery, whether it's the spinal injuries unit in the MAT, or particularly is the National Centre. And that is a really, really good centre, and they look after all the spinal cord injuries, traumatic injuries in the country, and other injuries. And that is the public sector, and that's where the expertise is, both from surgical, but particularly nursing. All the allied health professionals work in a big multidisciplinary team. Beyond that, then, the National Rehabilitation Hospital in Dunleary is where all the spinal cord injury patients go. And that's a really important place for...
That's public as well.
It's public. Yeah. So, and then some of the really difficult spinal deformities and pediatric spinal conditions are treated in the public system, because the multidisciplinary teams are there. And a lot of spinal cancer is treated in the public system. In the private system, there's a lot of complexity as well, but it's more elective, planned surgery. Some emergency surgery we would do as well.
So it's
mixed. And
depends on what the issue.
Yeah, depends on the issue.
What are the pros and cons of cervical disc replacement? 37-year-old hairdresser with a herniated disc.
Yeah, so what that is, a cervical disc replacement is, you take out the herniated disc, it's done through the front of your neck, and you free up the nerve, and you put in a replacement, which is like a prosthesis that
fake
moves.
Disc, yeah.
Fake disc, and it actually moves. Now, the idea of that is it preserves motion so that it doesn't stiffen it, because the alternative is a fusion, that you take out the disc and you fuse the two bones together, and you put a little plate onto, or a block, and the two bones grow together and they become stiff. Mm-hmm. Now, the idea when disc replacements came out was to preserve motion, their motion-preserving technology. Sounds great, but some more... And the idea is to preserve motion and protect the discs around it, that they don't get stressed from stiffening the neck. But the studies, recent studies would suggest that that isn't always the case, that there's not a huge amount of difference in the long run between particularly a one-level fusion and a disc replacement. So the long-term outcome may not be that different. Sounds great, but now I do disc replacements and I do fusions. Younger people, I would tend to do disc replacements, but some disc replacements would break down over time and need to be replaced with a fusion. So there's always strings attached to everything.
Do you have any advice on how to protect your back in younger years to avoid or defer back issues in later life?
Yeah, I think there's quite a few things you can do. Number one, your bone health is very important. So people don't realize that your maximum bone density is at 21, and then it's downhill from there.
21 years old.
21 years of age. Yeah. So, and that's really important that you try and make that peak as high as possible. And that means diet, good diet, no smoking, impact exercise, so staying fit and healthy and eating well and making sure your calcium intake is important. So bone health is really important.
So do you have an issue with all these oat milks coming in?
No, I don't. I don't.
Okay, great.
I'm not going to get into criticizing the dairy industry, but
okay.
I do have big issues with the dairy industry.
Okay, go on anyway. The other things you can do to protect your spine.
No, and I think there are many sources of calcium, and a balanced diet is really important. So I think your bone health is really important. Your musculoskeletal health, particularly, or your muscular health is really important. So being fit, being reasonably strong, having your core strong is really important. So particularly as you age, so your muscle strength, your muscle bulk is really important as you go through your years. So the stronger you are earlier in life, the better. Flexibility is also important that you, so you're flexible, you're strong, and if you keep that up. So Pilates, yoga, general core exercise is really important.
I had a DEXA scan, which yes. measured my bone density.
Yes.
Now, I had an eating disorder and I was anorexic and I was very overweight and I lost my period for 3.5 years. Mm. And they said that I had osteopenia, which yeah. was the start of osteoporosis. Yeah. But is that reversed? Now that I haven't had one since I kind of am in recovery and have now got a balanced diet and all that kind of stuff, does that come back up or is it like...
Yeah, it can. So you can improve your bone density with diet, with exercise, particularly impact exercise. So that's important. You can improve it. There are drugs that will increase your bone density, but generally, particularly in younger people, you would certainly go diet, exercise, impact exercise, and that often does reverse it. But and this is really important also, particularly women who are perimenopausal, that they understand that, number one, get a DEXA scan, and make sure they know what their baseline bone density is, and then diet and exercise.
And when you say really diet, do you mean like
calcium,
high protein?
Yeah,
calcium.
You should be. Most people should be on a calcium supplement with vitamin D, and certainly any woman that is in the perimenopausal period should be on calcium and vitamin D, regardless of their bone density.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts on cranial therapy or craniosacral therapy for babies and children?
I don't know a whole lot about it. Mm-hmm. I think it brings into the discussion, well, all the sort of alternative treatments for musculoskeletal pain, and there are many out there. And it's really difficult to say, well, what works, what doesn't work, what's worth paying for and what's not. Mm-hmm. A lot of techniques do work. A lot of, say, musculoskeletal pain can be due to stress, anxiety, and anything that helps that can help general musculoskeletal yeah. pain. But I think a good understanding of how your muscles work, your posture, is really important. But there are many, many treatments out there that don't work, that are... And I'm not saying anything about craniosacral therapy.
No, but just there are lots of things on offer.
Just research it a bit.
What do lesions on a spinal cord mean?
It depends. Lesion is a word that we use to sort of fudge it a little bit. So, okay. you know.
Some kind of growth?
Yeah. So, oh, you've got a lesion on your spinal cord. That could mean anything. It could mean a tumor. Could mean a benign tumor, malignant tumor. It could mean a spot that just shows up in an MRI. It could be what we see fairly frequently is what's called a demyelination plaque. So that's an area of high signal in your cord on an MRI, which might signify multiple sclerosis.
Okay, so it can range from absolutely nothing to something
yeah,
quite
so
serious.
Yeah, so it's sort of more of the spot on your spinal cord. It could be anything.
Yeah, I hope someone has been given that diagnosis and no further information.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of medical speak, and you just need to be careful when often, particularly in a consultation, you'd be really careful what words you come out with, and if you sort of, and be looking at your patient, not looking at the MRI. If you see shock on their face, you say, "Well, hang on a minute,
yeah.
this is the explanation of that." And
have you any experience with post-epidural complications?
Yes. Now, there's different types of epidurals. So most frequently you hear it post-epidural for, say, childbirth.
Yeah.
And that will be, what can happen is that the epidural punctures the dura. That's the sleeve over the nerves that we were speaking about earlier.
Yeah.
And then spinal fluid leaks out and people get a headache.
Okay.
And
does that, it heal itself over time?
Often it does. And then sometimes what they'll do is take blood from the arm
yeah.
of the same patient and inject it in around the hole, and it just seals it like a clot. But sometimes you do hear of issues going on and on and on, becoming chronic. Now, often they're not necessarily related to the epidural. But maybe
the labor more so.
It's probably the labor. And a lot of people say, oh, my back is destroyed by the epidural.
But if you give birth on your back, like, it's not.
Generally, it's something else. And
I had two epidurals because the first one didn't work.
But in many cases, when you have a woman in labor and you're the anaesthetist trying to get an epidural in, and they're jumping around and you can't feel anything, and it can be quite a difficult thing. You get moving targets all the time, and so there can be several attempts, or it doesn't work because it's not in perfectly in the right place, or the fluid, the anaesthetic doesn't percolate down in the correct place. So things happen.
I've been told by my GP that my disc is slipping out of my spine, but my physio says that's not possible, that discs can't slip in and out of spines. So I don't know what to do. Who should I trust? What's your opinion on the link?
It's something I hear a lot of. Oh, my discs are slipping in and out. Discs don't slip in and out. So a disc will bulge out. It can shrink down, but a disc isn't something that sort of goes in and out.
Yeah, I think that's what people have. That's my image.
The disc is actually quite a decent structure. There's quite a tough ligament around it.
So when it bulges, is it that the ligament is inflamed or has it
moved? Yeah, well, usually what happens, the ligament at the back, which is at between the disc and the spinal canal, so the outer sort of rim of the disc, can either, you get a little split in it and a piece of disc comes out, or it'll bulge. Now, that bulge can change. It doesn't slip in and out, but a bulge can get bigger, say, if you're sitting for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Because often people say, well, listen, when I sit, my pain gets worse or my
but
leg starts...
But what's bulging there?
It is the disc.
And is the disc made of bone?
No, the disc is made of sort of jelly cartilage.
Okay, stuff is moving, kind of like the sea moves with the tide.
It's a bit like a tire. If you press on a tire, it'll bulge somewhere. Now, there's a natural bulge in a healthy disc when it's loaded, but if it's a bit worn...
So like you're sitting on an exercise ball, it bulges.
Exactly, it has to go somewhere.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. But I think we have this idea of it like being a CD that's kind of slipped out.
No. But it does bulge. It can bulge in and out, and depends on what you're doing. And
do you think that there's any effect on the spine of us constantly being looking down at our phones?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say no.
Yeah, I haven't started to see social media neck, but...
but it's happening.
Yeah, and there's also a few head injuries from people walking to lampposts.
But people will be stupid. They could do that anytime. So you think? Do you think that like humans will actually evolve and be fine, or we'll have injuries?
Well, I think you do. So if you constantly flex your neck down, day in day out for hours, it has an effect. You're going to get degenerative change in your neck. So if you start that when you're in your teens and continue it on forever, you're going to probably, and this is a probably, see accelerated degeneration in the neck as time goes by, which is great for us because it keeps us in business. But.
Well, as long as you're making money. This is a very boring question, but what mattress is actually better for your spine, and is there a best sleep position?
The answer is it varies so much that...
From person to person?
Person to person.
Okay.
I think what I would suggest... You need a reasonably medium sort of mattress, firm mattress. Often a little topper of memory foam is quite good, particularly if you have back pain. Mm-hmm. And what you're trying to do is keep your spine straight no matter what position you're in. So if you're on your back or on your side, you're trying to keep your spine straight or your neck in relation to the rest of your spine. If you're sleeping like that, it's not great. Or if your spine sags in the middle and your pelvis tilts in bed, and you've wear and tear in your back, you'll often start getting back pain. You wake up and have to turn over. So not too hard, not too soft, medium, maybe some memory foam, but it's often a personal thing. Some people will say, that was the best night's sleep I ever had. You're in some hotel somewhere, so that was a nice mattress, and you're lifting the sheets looking at what it is.
But it's also probably the fact that it's been slept on by thousands of people, so it's not. That's the thing, like you go and you lie down in the shop and you're like, this is a very comfy mattress, and then you buy it and it's way more firm.
Everyone has
slept on the other one.
You want the secondhand one.
So definitely you don't want a secondhand one. Is doing weights, lifting weights, good for your back?
It is. And there's a couple of schools of thought on that. So you've got the deadlifting school that like deadlifts and there's the other school of thought that's saying, well, maybe that's not such a good idea. But we do know that if you toughen up the muscles at the back of your spine, particularly the base of your spine, it's pretty good for back pain. So I think if you're going to lift weights, you do it properly. Your technique is really important. So if you say, oh, I'll go in and start lifting weights, number one, it has to be a gradual increase while you're conditioning. Mm-hmm. You just don't go in and lift 40 kilos and think you're going to get away with it. But it has to be supervised initially. So, for example, a deadlift is a common exercise that's used for back pain. I've seen plenty of injuries with deadlifts. Or I see lots of people who go to the gym and say, oh yeah, we were having a deadlifting competition between the lads and they felt some go. And that's usually overexertion and it's just poor technique. So your form in a deadlift is really important. But like, it's not crazy. If you go crazy and lift really heavy weights, unless you're really into your bodybuilding, you know what you're doing, you're going to hurt yourself. But weightlifting is important. It's good exercise, but needs to be done right.
Needs to be done right. Lots of people asking about the best way to sleep to prevent back and neck pain. As you say, it's different person to person, but just try and keep your spine straight.
Yeah, so if your pillow straighter is your spine, the better. Low, yeah.
What's your opinion on chiropractors?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And so I think chiropractors, one of the things about chiropractors is, and their interaction with, say, doctors or spine surgeons or... is that there isn't any interaction. So we don't really know much about it. I've spoken to chiropractors, some really good chiropractors, and it works, but it needs to be done correctly. And a very good chiropractor is actually a good clinician. They know what cases not to treat, what cases to treat. And some of them get really good results. It is something that is somewhat unregulated that... it's difficult to know, well, who's really well-trained, who's not. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I suppose, as a spine surgeon, you have a minimum level that you have to achieve. But, you know, I'd never say, oh, that's not appropriate. It's not, because, you know, a chiropractor could easily turn around to me and say, well, spine surgery is not successful in...
Yeah.
15% of people that you operate on, so...
Is that statistic true?
Yeah, about that. So... Yeah. Particularly for pain, so back pain, neck pain, arm pain, leg pain. So there's a 15% failure rate. Now, it's more dissatisfaction rate. So there's a difference between dissatisfaction and failure.
And is it, of course, is it a case that like sometimes, this might sound awful, but sometimes I think people get kind of attached to their pain, like it's such a part of their lives that like after surgery, they might be like, well, it's still there.
Yeah, sometimes that is, and particularly with sort of severe long-term pain, the brain gets used to it and it gets imprinted in the brain. So when you take away the pain, it can be still there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is certainly common. But a lot of people who have spinal problems and get treated for, say, a really severe, say, sciatica, they've really bad pain down their legs or legs, and you go in and you take out the disc and their leg pain is gone. They still have back pain because they have a lot of wear and tear in their, their back. And they say, well, I still have my back pain. I still can't play golf. I thought you were going to fix me. So it's really important to talk to people beforehand and say, well, listen, we're fixing one thing, but you're still going to have the other.
Reminds me of my grandfather, like until the day he died, he had several issues. He had issues with his lungs, prostate cancer, you know, didn't live the healthiest life. But every single doctor he saw, he was like, yeah, well, you fixed my cataract, but I still have this pain in my back. They were like, well, I'm an ophthalmologist, Sean, so.
Expectation management is very important in what I do.
Yeah, I guess it is.
It is. No, it's one of the most important because the things we discuss at your average consultation is, particularly a surgical consultation, is yes, you discuss everything. I like my patients to know what's wrong with them and what they're having and what the alternatives are. But it's also to say, well, this is what you're going to expect. This is what can happen. This is what the outcome is, but it's not always what you want. And there are a few risks, and you have to understand that. And but managing expectations is important.
My last question then from the followers, I don't know if you can answer this. What is the next step when radio frequency lesioning doesn't work anymore? What is that first?
Yeah, so radio frequency lesioning is basically when they burn away the little nerves at the back of your spine to deaden the joints, usually the joints, commonly at the base of the back, but also in the neck.
Okay.
And if there's an arthritic joint, painful joint, you can zap it and kill off the nerves and that can numb it. When that fails, it depends really on whether it really depends on what's wrong. But in some instances, a spinal fusion will be appropriate, where you actually surgically stiffen that part of the spine with screws and rods and stop it from moving. But that has to be really thought carefully about and considered. It's not always the right option.
And then my last question to you before I sort of open it up to anything you think we should know, are there any symptoms that you think people should never ignore, that it's like, actually, that could be quite serious, that you see now and again that could be a bigger issue?
Yeah, I certainly progressive numbness or weakness of an arm, a hand, a leg is something that you don't sit around and hoping it's going to get better. You need to go to your doctor. And loss of the ability to walk, which might sound obvious, but as people get older, they'll say, "Oh well, I'm getting old. I'm staggering around." Well, usually there's something wrong. It's particularly if it's happening quickly.
Okay.
And in many cases, that's a spinal problem. I think if one of the big spinal emergencies would be if a disc herniates in the back and you lose control of your bladder or difficulty passing urine, numbness around the saddle area. If you imagine sitting on a saddle, if that area were to go numb, that's pretty much a surgical emergency. So you need a rapid MRI and you need surgery, ideally within 8 hours.
And if that happens and there's no trauma behind it, is that generally there's a tumor there or something has happened?
No, you can sneeze and herniate a disc, or a lot of discs just herniate. Now, it's not to scare everyone, but most disc herniations happen just out of the blue.
So herniated disc is
a slip disc, or it's not a slipping disc in and out, it's a protruding disc. It's
so
a disc
that fluid in the disc
has just squirts out or bulges out into the spinal canal and presses on the nerve. So
they're the
types of things that you don't hang around with. Really severe pain. So somebody who has a really severe pain that's not getting better, particularly pain at night, pain at rest, that would be concerning, that there's something going on in your spine, either a fracture. Now, again, all of these things you have to put in the context. Well, how do you feel? What's your medical history? Mm-hmm. But very intrusive pain that is just not getting better and getting
worse. So people
are
managing pain themselves at home with like Solpidine or Nurofen Plus for a sustained period of time, that's not normal.
I mean, certainly you should check with your doctor. Now, most, you can get severe back pain that really incapacitates you, as in you can't move.
But that would be acute, wouldn't it?
It's usually
not like
acute.
Every
it usually
day,
goes away fairly quickly, a couple of days, and it's starting to get better. Yeah. But in most cases, people who get that go to their doctor anyway. But it's that sort of insidious pain that's just there, particularly in the thoracic area between the shoulder blades. It's just there day and night. That needs to be looked at.
Okay. And is there anything else that you think we should know that I haven't asked?
I think one of the things about spine surgery and spine in general is it's a very big specialty. There's a lot of expertise. There's a lot of options for people. Surgery is one of the options. It's important that a lot of people who think they might need surgery consider all the options and maybe wait and see, will symptoms abate?
So it's kind of the last resort.
Yeah, well, in many cases, but often it's the first resort. So, but it's also going to the correct person that will pick the right thing for you. And your GP is the first port of call, and they'll generally point you in the right direction.
And like, in the MAT or private network, like, can people, so someone's listening to this and they need to have spinal surgery, can you pick who you want, or do you sort of, you're an assessed and it's like, well, I think this guy has the best specialty for you?
Yeah, you generally go to your GP and get a referral, and you can say, I want to go to this person, and a referral will come in and that will go to that person. Now, I have two other spine surgeons working with me. We spread out the referrals because there's just so many of them. Mm-hmm. But I still look at all the referrals. So every day I will go through all the referrals that come in for the previous day and say, okay, this is for me, that's for you, and just triage it on a daily basis. So, but yeah, if somebody wants to see me and doesn't want to see anyone else, that's fine.
That's fine. Ask your GP for a referral. Mr. Ashley Poynton, thank you so much for joining
Thanks
me
very
in
much,
studio
Stephanie.
Today.
Pleasure.
You have listened to another episode of Basically. Our music is by Only Ruin. Our graphic design is by Cathal O'Gara. We're produced by Julie Hassett, and we're part of the Headstuff Podcast Network. See you next week.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.